Welcome to No Picks After Dark, Baltimore Sun's best podcast of 2020, voted by you, the listeners. No Picks After Dark seeks to build a community based on human experience, storytelling, and conversation. Now your host, Aaron Dante.
Welcome to the No Picks After Dark podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Dante. Today, we have a very, very special panel, not guest, panel. And, you know, we've been really stressed out in America right now, and everybody's going through some problems and issues, and I was going through some stress after everything that's going on. I didn't know how to speak with people. I didn't want to talk to my white friends for a while. I just put myself in a shell, didn't want to talk to anybody because it was PTSD for me. There's some things that happened to me in my past, and I will explain that in later podcast, but I've been where George Floyd's been, but not to that extent. You know, I've had 10 guns pointed at my head, and I could have died. And just seeing that, it just brought back a lot of memories to me. And fortunate enough, I'm here to be talking about with you guys. And again, now I wanted to talk about it. So I said, let me get a good panel, a good cross-section panel of people that I know. And I think they would give a good representation of what my friends are, who they are. And I'm very proud to have them on the No Picks of Dark podcast to talk about this very, very important subject. So without further ado, let's introduce my guests. Go ahead, ladies first.
All right, Q, do you want to take it?
Sure. Yeah.
All right.
My name is Quintina. I currently live in Charlotte, North Carolina, but I'm originally from Jersey and living in mostly North Jersey, but definitely, I guess, kind of my experience is both in the city of Jersey and kind of the suburbs of Jersey. Currently, I'm a college professor at Johnson & Wales.
And what about racism? What was the first time you ever had racist things happen to you?
It was early, for sure. So in my experience growing up, I was born and lived my small childhood in the city in Passaic in Paterson, New Jersey. And probably around maybe like second, third grade, my parents decided that we were going to move to the suburbs, right? And that's actually my first experience with racism and having somebody either say something racist to me or hearing it about someone else. That was also new to me. I didn't know any of that existed for real. Like, I had seen it in, you know, like on TV or movies or hear other people talk about it, but me personally, I hadn't experienced it until probably early grade school, maybe like fourth, fifth grade.
Wow. So that's a young age. That's a very young age.
Mm-hmm.
Be traumatized already. All right.
It was, yeah.
All right. So I'm Christy Frank. I live here in Baltimore. As Aaron mentioned, we're neighbors in the Lauraville neighborhood, Lauraville-ish, Northeast Baltimore. I just moved to Baltimore a year ago. I was in Nashville for about 15 years prior to moving here. But I was born and raised around the Hampton Roads area of Virginia, which is kind of in the southeast around like Williamsburg, Yorktown, Jamestown, all that stuff, which obviously is a really has a loaded history, you know, as an area. And I think growing up in that, you know, in that environment, I got, I don't know, a lot of the, you know, the history of slaves and kind of the beginnings of our country came to me probably in a very filtered way, based on the fact that my area was very white. My town growing up and my experience throughout school was, you know, my school, I would say, was probably 95% white. I remember kind of early on, there was an area that fed into my elementary school called Lackey that was where a lot of the Black population lived and tended to be, poorer kids, kids coming from backgrounds that were very different from mine. And I remember noticing that really, really early in my experience as a student. I have family who come from the deeper South than Virginia. So I definitely remember, growing up and having family gatherings and like hearing racist jokes early on that maybe took a while for me to understand where those were coming from or what they meant. Obviously I moved from Virginia to Nashville, another extremely white city in the South. And then coming here, I think has been just such an interesting experience in terms of kind of coming face to face with a city that has been broken in a million different ways by racism and racist policy. And I think that's been almost a chance for me to have to go through and kind of re-educate myself all over again from that perspective. So that's where I'm coming from.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Andy or Tony, where?
I'll go ahead. I'm Andy Ellis. I grew up in Northern Virginia suburbs, and then I graduated high school in Frederick, Maryland, both predominantly white communities that were more diverse in terms of international folks than they were largely Black or Latino. They both had military bases nearby, and so there was a lot of people who came in. Went to college at Towson University in Baltimore, and then for about 10 years, I traveled around coaching college debate. That took me to some places like Long Beach, California, that feel a lot like Baltimore, and some places like Burlington, Vermont, and Laramie, Wyoming, that are exactly the opposite of 65% Black. I think that the first time I experienced racism, or I knew about what racism was I knew about it intellectually because my grandfather was involved in the civil rights movement at the University of South Carolina and was one of the folks who helped to lead the integration of the University of South Carolina. So it was part of our family history to the struggle for civil rights. But I don't think I realized it as a visceral thing that I saw people I know experience until I was in high school. And I went and one of the towns near us had a Klan rally at some point. And we went as protesters. And I think that is really when I stepped into understanding the stories that my grandfather had told about the way that this worked and the way that it hadn't ended in his era. And was still alive. And then I've lived in Baltimore since 2005. I don't plan on leaving. I love it here. And I think that race shapes the city, but shapes the hard parts about the city, but also I think the Black experience shapes the future of the city in a way that is going to provide a model for the rest of the world to figure out how to come out of some of the hardest times and build a future that's the way we want it to be.
So my name is Tony, and same to kind of piggyback off that, my family's really into history. So growing up, me and my sisters watching PBS, we watched like every Kenny Burns documentary, like just history on America in general. So we was always knowledgeable about race and everything like that from the jump. I think the first time I experienced it for myself outside of like a PBS special was probably middle school, to be honest. But it was to the point where it just really didn't hit until like moments later, from the actual moment. I think we were going to the mall. I was getting a ride to the mall with my two boys, my boy Chapman, who's there now, rest in peace. But Chapman's, he's Caucasian. And it was me, Chapman, and Noah. And Noah's dad was taking us to the mall. So, and Noah is, I think he's Pakistan. So I was really the only Black guy in the car, So I remember his dad taking us to the mall, and he just kept, before we went in, he was like, "Yo, make sure you guys don't steal anything from the mall." And like, he's just making eye contact with me. But I'm so oblivious as a kid. I'm like, yeah, like, of course not. Make sure you guys pay for everything. And just like, still not getting it. Like, yeah, you know. And then it wasn't until we got out the car and Chapman was like, no, why would your dad keep saying don't steal from him? He never tells us that we go to the mall. And he was, you know, and I'm just like, well, we do have Tony now, you know. And it's just like, you know, it's like one of those moments, like, I get it. I'm the guy, you know. And so it was like one of those moments that was just like, what? You know, but, and that's like on like on the polite side, of course, you know, that's something that's like traumatic, but not, there's way, you know, there's bigger scenarios than that. But I think recognizing, again, it's like in the moment that when it happens, you don't recognize it as an adolescent until it happens. Then it's just like, oh, and then I think I was just so surprised by the moment because I was like a very quiet kid. Like I wouldn't even dare to even be like, dude, that's racist. You know what I'm saying? But so just sort of things like that, I think, you know, that kind of like molded and just made me more just mindful, you know, of little things like that. So
I will say just a little quick tidbit. Like I experienced it so many different times in my life, but I'm going to tell you probably the most time that was really impactful for my friends was when we're all out of college, have great jobs, working for Wegmans back up in Jersey. And I was going with my friends from Philadelphia. We're flying to Miami the next day. We went to the mall. And I remember something, I have a good job. You know, I'm not dressing, you know, I'm not dressed. I'm not looking bad. And I'm with my good friend, Mike, and his sister, Emily. Emily buys a gift from the, I think it was Nordstrom's or one of those stores. No problem. Buys a credit card, pays for it. Mike buys something, credit card, pays for it. The black boy comes last, and the white teller cashier says, can I see your ID? Now, that was probably one of the first times they saw it blatant. And this is when they're 20-something years old. And I looked at the guy and said, excuse me? He said, I need to see your ID to make sure who you are. Mm-hmm. And this is like, again, 2005, 2006, not that far away. And for me, I was shocked. I said, you know what? I don't want to buy anything. Wow. I'm good. And they were shocked because they had never seen racism up in their face. And they are both Polish immigrants, but they've never seen it like as far as a black male seeing it like they're back when their friends happened to them. And, you know, it's always the running joke years later, but I always reflect on that day because that's the moment that they realize this is crazy. I can't believe our friend, college degree, great job, got his own car, living good. His question, when they just bought two things and my item was cheaper. So I always remember that. That sticks out to me the most. Just, I mean, there's so many things I could talk about, but I'm glad everybody was honest and shared about their experiences because I know it's pretty hard. You know, Chrissy, you said about your family, you heard racist jokes. That's pretty hard to swallow when you think about it. You know, years later, you hear, you're like, damn, like everybody was laughing at this joke. And now I guess we're part of the issue also, not the solution. So I kudos for you to come out and say that. I really appreciate that. So, the panel, I mean, when did you guys start hearing about Black history? Who taught you guys about Black history? I mean, as you know, it's whitewashed. So, like, how did you guys, I mean, who did you learn besides MLK? You know what I mean? Because that's always the go-to for white America, you know? So, again, or Harriet Tubman or Frederick Douglass. That's the go-to. Or they tell you Malcolm X is a bad guy. But was he really? So, again, the panel, go ahead. Please explain, when did you first start learning about Black history? And did you learn it from a friend? Did you learn it from school? Did your parents take it upon themselves to teach you, like how my parents taught me? Go ahead first, ladies. Q, go ahead.
I'll go. So that's actually, I never understood how important it was until later on in school that my first introduction to Black history and just being proud to be Black before I even knew what that meant or was, actually was my babysitter. So everybody in the neighborhood went to the same babysitter, Mrs. Jones and her husband, Mr. Jones. And we listened to talk radio, and we were only allowed to watch PBS. And after a certain age, right, which is still a little kid, like Mr. Jones would take the bigger kids and sit us in the front porch. And he actually had, this is like, I feel super old for saying this, he had speeches on tape of different Black leaders. I swear to you, different leaders, different talks, different, we didn't even understand what half of it meant. And he would just sit us down, put the tape in the deck, and press play. And then he would quiz us on what we heard at the end. So you couldn't like be slick and take a nap because he would walk away. So you had to listen. That was probably the first, my first kind of introduction to what it means to be Black. So I didn't understand everything that I was listening to, but I just understood that this was serious. And it didn't make sense to me really more until after we moved to the suburbs. And, you know, I always liked to learn, always liked to go to school, and history was one of my favorite subjects. And I was so crushed when, you know, I got a little bit older and looking for where my history was in the textbook, because we talked about everyone else's immigrant history. You know, we learned about Ellis Island, we learned about, you know, the Italian immigrants and the German immigrants and the Polish immigrants and the Jewish immigrants. And so I was just waiting for, you know, like, where's my chapter? Oh, I was so sad to see them two little sad paragraphs about slavery. And oh, I was so sad and hurt. But it's, I have to credit my parents, but mostly my mom, for encouraging me to read about and to talk about. I know those folks were tired of me by the time I left and went to high school, because every book report, every research report was about somebody Black and famous. My mom let me read Malcolm X by any means necessary. Like, I don't even know why that was at the book fair, but it was there and I bought it. so I, you know, I read it all, and I wanted to understand and learn it all. And whatever I learned, that was my opportunity to stand up and say, this is who I am. I'm not just these two paragraphs in this book that says, you know, I got captured and, or my ancestors got captured, and that's why I'm here. The end. That's not my story. That was never our story.
So I really had to kind of reach back and think about where I first heard about, or started learning about Black history. And I think, like, from my perspective, I think growing up in that kind of original colonial area, a lot of what I learned was kind of through the lens of plantations, which is like horrible to think back to. But, you know, it's hard, like, as you grow up, you learn a lot about your state's history. That's a lot of what the emphasis is, I think, when you're in the lower grades. But, you know, you can't learn about Virginia's history without learning about slavery. You know, you can't learn about it without learning about kind of those structures that built, you know, the country that we have today. I do think, you know, I remember a huge emphasis on Black History Month. I remember, like, you know, it kind of trying to squeeze all of Black history into like one month. It's like, okay, this is what we're going to do now. Which is like, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there was more kind of outside of that, but I mean, yeah, it was a lot of going through. I wouldn't say that what I learned sidestepped around the horror of slavery. I think there was a lot of emphasis placed, like, it was unequivocally a bad thing. You know, it wasn't like I feel like a lot of friends that I've heard growing up in the South kind of heard this wishy-washy story of slavery, and that was not my experience. But I definitely, like, when you get into kind of the civil rights movement, especially around MLK and Rosa Parks and all of those stories, I do feel like that was an incredibly whitewashed version that I got based on what I know today. You know, I can look back and you know, realize that, like, I thought MLK was a peaceful, nonviolent protester 100% of the time And that was how he got things done, because that was how I learned it, you know, when I was in school. And it probably wasn't until 5 years ago, you know, that I learned about the letter that the FBI sent him telling him to kill himself. Like, that was like, I think I've been kind of on this journey of like relearning a lot of that type of stuff in my adult life. But again, as I've come from primarily white areas between Virginia and Nashville, I think the truth of the matter is, like, it's never been front and center, you know, Black history has never been front and center. So, it's interesting to hear, hear everybody's experience with it, because I think it does vary so much depending on where you came from, which I guess is why we're having this conversation. It's a big part of it.
Me or Tony?
Oh, you go ahead. No, you go ahead, Andy. You got it, man.
All right. Okay. So, I was a high school debater, and I debated in college. And in the late 90s, there was a movement to bring debate, which had primarily been a suburban, white, and diverse activity, to urban high schools. And so I helped to get the Baltimore Urban Debate League founded, because I thought it was a good idea, but I wasn't really dug into the idea yet. And there was an article that was written by a guy named Dr. Eddie Warner. And Dr. Eddie Warner was the director of debate at the University of Louisville. And he was one of the few Black PhD directors of debate in the country. And he wrote about Malcolm X's prison debate experience, and how when Malcolm X was in prison, he joined the Norfolk Prison Colony debate team and learned that debating both sides of an issue helped him to have an understanding both of where his opponents were coming from, but also how they were constructing their arguments in order to destroy their arguments. And so that got me sort of diving into Malcolm X and what came out of that. And I would say that my first adolescence, I was very much into history, white history, American history, Virginia history. But in my second adolescence, during my 20s, I really dove with both feet into Black history. I was working in Black schools. I was working in predominantly Black areas. And debate is an intense reading activity. So for probably a decade, I don't think I read any nonfiction book by a white author. I only was reading Black theory, Black history, Black politics, and ultimately I got to a point where I was coaching a debate team at Towson University in 2005 that was the goal of our debate team was to take kids from the Baltimore City Urban Debate League and allow them to compete at the highest levels of college debate, and they did so by reading deeply into Black history, Black philosophy, and Black theory. And as a coach, I had to read a lot of that stuff, and it was great. I mean, I dove in more deeply than anything I'd ever dove into before. And there was a point at that period where there's a book by Adam Mansbaugh who describes himself as an angry Black white boy. And that was sort of my go-to for a while. I was quoting Malcolm X, I was quoting Marcus Garvey, and I still appreciate all of those histories, but I for a while sort of fashioned myself the most down white boy in any room that I was in. And I think that it was a helpful way to dive into a really deep history and understand that there is a deep Black intellectual tradition in the United States, aside from what we were taught in school. And, you know, so that was sort of my entry point, and I don't think I've come out of that. I still think I primarily am reading Black history, Black philosophy, and Black politics. And I think it's important to when I live in a city that is 65% Black, to understand that the political experience that I'm guiding my work off of should come mostly from Black folks.
Yeah, that's... I'm the same. I'm glad I'm going at the helm. We on the same way when it comes to background and materials. For real, this is good, man. I'm the same. Like I said, my family is very big into history. Being from Virginia as well, we lived in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which, like, historically, that was like one of the bloodiest parts of the Civil War. They won't ever let you forget that in Fredericksburg. You go down there, it's all you see is Civil War memorabilia everywhere. You know, I lived with my grandfather for a while. My parents got divorced. My grandfather, I always thought he was rich because he had a library in his house. I don't know why. At a young age, I just equated the books to like money, which in a sense is like, you know, really wisdom in a sense. So I was just amazed at the books he had, like Marcus Garvey, James Baldwin, you know, and speaking of which, I love hearing the debates between Malcolm and James Baldwin, you know, the ones, you know, that have at Harvard. Just getting involved with the history for us, it was just like watching TV. It was so natural, you know, because it was always something new. And being a writer, Langston Hughes, he's my all-time writer, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's my, you know, him and James Baldwin, just because I was just amazed at 10 years old that you can make a living just off writing. I'm like, yo, this dude is making a living in the Harlem Renaissance by writing? He ain't tap dancing? He ain't doing what else? He's not doing, you know? Shooting on the side with Detroit Ray, like, we doing this? That's amazing, you know? So I was just amazed. And again, you know, the cool thing about today is that we got documentaries on Netflix where it's really becoming the norm. You know what I'm saying? Back in the day, if you missed a special on PBS, that was it, you know? I didn't have too many friends that watched that back in the day. Like, it was just like, dude, why are you watching that? TRL's on, you know what I'm saying? Just like, and so I think as just becoming... just being enriched with Black history at a young age. And of course, my grandfather being a pastor, heavy Black history mom, you had to go on the podium and, you know, read something about Black history. You know, every kid in the church had to do it. So for us, it was just like, it was normal. You know, it was normal, just like anything else. But I think now as an adult, I think it's amazing to keep continuing, you know, being with it. You know, I mean, reading Dr. Cornel West books, you know, and just hearing his lectures is off top. It's just like, I get chills listening to him like I would listen to a Jay-Z album. You know what I'm saying? To me, it's just because it's just knowledge, you know what I'm saying? And just, you know, and his history, you know what I'm saying? He's translating in a way that's so relatable. And so, you know, it's just, it's right there. You know what I'm saying? Like, you feel it. So, yeah, I was definitely introduced to Black history young. And then just a way to encourage me. I guess at an early age, my parents just wanted to encourage me to know that there are a lot of great Black people other than Michael Jordan. You know, like, I know you love Jordan, you know, but there's other Black people that's out there, you know, that you should check out, you know. And they caught my curiosity because I was, you know, I was curious, you know, and I'm so thankful for, you know, to this day, because those are like, you know, those are my heroes.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for your honesty and your truth and whatnot. So I'm going to ask this question. It's this two-part question here. When did you have your first white or Black friend growing up? And it's interesting, have you ever slept over the opposite race's house, even to friends? Have you ever done that? Because I grew up and I went to private schools my whole entire life. And guess what? I look back at it, my white friends never slept over my house. I want you to think about that. My white friends, quote unquote friends, never slept over my house, but I was always at their house. I went to their house, but I never slept over their. I mean, so I thought about that and I was like, let me ask this question, because it kind of baffled me, because I'm thinking back, why didn't they ever come over my house? Why did they never slept over? You know, so I just something to think about. So Q, start off, go ahead.
It's funny that you said that about the sleepovers. And, you know, thinking about this conversation really made me kind of go back and think, knowing the premise. And it brought a lot of stuff to my mind that I was like, dang, I never even thought about that like that before. Like I said, when we moved, It was me and one other kid that was the Black population in that town. At the elementary school, it was like one Asian family, you know, maybe like two Jewish families that I knew of. So it was a different faith, and it was weird because we kind of all lived around the same. Like the same Black without even knowing it. We didn't know these people, right? But my first friend of a different race, my first white friend, and I didn't realize it until kind of later, because you know, you're young and you just have friends. she was kind of, the other kids would always say stuff like, oh no, don't hang out with her or don't talk to her. You know, she's, you know, just don't, like, she's not good enough or she's this or that, but they did, like, they kind of danced around it. And I didn't understand it until later we got older. It was because she was Jewish. And like, even that kind of weird pecking order, that blew my mind. Between the kids that had a Polish background or the kids that had, you know, just different backgrounds and what the other kids would say. And I'm like, all of this is right. Like, are y'all for real right now? But just having her as my first friend that we, you know, she was, it was so funny. She was, her dad's side of the family was Jewish. Her mom's side of the family was Italian. It was crazy. Like, the food was crazy, crazy, crazy. And her father was a chef. And I think that's why we really clicked. Because of the food. And we were just friends too. And thinking about it, as far as like sleepovers and stuff, I think this, and that was kind of later on, that might have been the first sleepover, because we didn't sleep over, period. Like, my mother was very funny about that. My whole family is very funny about that, because you have no idea how people live when they go home and close their doors, and anything can happen. And they needed to keep their eye on us. And I understood that. So if we spent the night, it was with your cousins, basically. But I remember like pestering my mom, because, you know, when you're in school, you get all the invitations, come to my sleepover, come to my sleepover. And she would always tell me, we don't do that. We don't do that. And I would be like, why don't we do that? Clearly everybody around us do that. Why can't we do? So I'll never forget it. Before I started going over to other people's houses to sleep over, first off, the girl that was my friend, she lived down the street, and my mother and dad had been over there and met her parents, you know, back and forth a couple of times before we started sleeping over each other's house. I had a birthday party. My mom invited basically everybody that I had put on a list of girls that I wanted to invite. If those girls were not at that party, she didn't tell me this at the time, but I recognized it afterwards. If those girls did not show up to that sleepover party, I was not allowed to go over to their house. So in her mind, it was, if it's okay for you to let your child come over here and stay in our home, you know, and trust that we're not going to do anything to your child, then I trust that I can let my child go and stay at your home. Kind of like a vetting process, really, because you don't know what's going to happen. And by that time, I had been called names. I had, you know, heard people say stuff, not only from children, but from adults. So it was really kind of, you know, that just that kind of not knowing, you know, and after that, even then, like, she was still very like, who is that? And I would say, oh, you don't remember such and such. They came over. They were at the sleepover. Oh, okay. Well, I still need to talk to their parents. I still need to speak to her mom or whatever. So it was it was a little bit tricky, because spending a night sleepover, right? We say spending the night. You just didn't do. Sleepover.
All right. My first Black friend in school, I think was, I had two Black girls in my Girl Scout troop. My mom was our scout leader from the time I was, I think, in kindergarten through like fourth or fifth grade. And we had, yeah, I think it was two Black girls who were kind of off and on members of that troop. And they were, I think our troop was only like 10 girls or something. I remember they were friends of mine. They were never close friends of mine, I think. I'm kind of with you, Q, that like we had a super limited amount of people that I would go over and spend the night with. So I had one friend who lived down the street, who my parents knew their parents really well. And we would have sleepovers. And that was about it. I think there might've been one or two other girls that I had sleepovers with when I was in elementary school. So yeah, I never went to a sleepover at a Black friend's house.
So yeah, when I was in elementary school and middle school, it was like, there were a diverse group of people in our community. So like there was my Asian friend, Mike, and there were my neighbors who were from Afghanistan, and there were some other East or South Asian folks in the neighborhood. And we definitely did have like sleepovers at their houses, but there weren't really Black folks in our area. And it wasn't really until I was in college that that became a question or an experience, right? And even then, I would say that it was weird for parents of college friends. Black, I remember a time when I went to stay at the home of a Black college friend, and mom was like, who's this guy you're bringing into the house, right? And, you know, my beard looked like it does now, or my hair was all stringy, you know, like, and mom was just sort of not feeling it. But I mean, it didn't happen when I was young. And it didn't happen in elementary or middle school, just because our community and our school didn't have Black folks as much as it had like the sort of diverse UN school type of feel to it of international folks. There were definitely African folks in my middle school because their parents were working in DC, but they hung out amongst other international folks and other diplomats folks. And that was, I think there was willing self-segregation on both sides in that case. And so, my house was never really a place where people stayed over. My mom was, by the time I was in second grade, it was just me and my mom. And she didn't really like having people stay at the house, but I stayed at a lot of people's houses. And they were diverse, but it was white folks and diverse folks, not Black folks per se.
It's tough because, yeah, I'm in the same boat. I feel like I stayed at so many different people's houses. I'm like, did my mom love me? Did she feed me? I feel like every weekend I was at somebody else's house. I think I was just that kid. I was just like, oh, isn't that people at your house? In peace? I'm over there. We did have someone, trying to think of, my memory escapes me when it comes to names, but like I know for sure I can answer the first part. I have stayed over many people houses who were not people of color, and it was cool. I mean, they definitely eat dinner much earlier than we do, and that was like a culture shock. You know, I'm just like, what? Sun is still out. This is awesome. You know, like, and then with like the other, you know, like I think with us, yeah, it's, you know, man, I can't remember really having like white kids staying over our house. Like they definitely hung out of that house for sure. You know what I'm saying? But then again, my mom, she was the type of woman that when she got out of work, you know, it was just like, all right, mom said, cool, we gone. You know what I'm saying? Because she was just like that, you know. She's a born again Christian now. She doesn't remember any of that. But like back in the day, she was like definitely like, when she put her foot down, that was it. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I maybe had one, you know, maybe in middle school, but it wasn't, and I think only because my mom, you know, already met their parents and everything like that. There was definitely an interaction there, you know, and he would always come to our house after school anyway. I can't think of his name, but only one, though. Be honest, I can't think of any. Yeah, I can't, that was it. I think it was only one.
So the next question here. When you were growing up, this is not on the sheet. So this is the bonus question here, not on the sheet. And when you're growing up, what did your parents teach you about the police? Because I'm pretty sure we're going to have a couple different explanations here. So because I've talked to my neighbors and they're all white. And we have told different experiences of how he or she was raised, and I was raised with the police. So we'll start with Christy. Let's start with you.
All right. I mean, I think a hallmark of white people is that we don't have a lot of conversations about the police growing up. It tends to be the assumption that those are the helpers, you know, like those are the people who come by when you're when you need something. I definitely remember, you know, having the talk with my parents to like, if you get pulled over, like keep your hands on the steering wheel. Don't, you know, do any of, you know, don't reach into the glove box. Don't do any of that stuff. And obviously, you know, that's exacerbated times like 1,000 for people who are not white. But by and large, I came out of my childhood, I think, with the view that, you know, police were the good guys.
And that's what I was going for right there. I was, that's what a lot of my friends have said. Andy, go ahead.
Neutral to good. I mean, there was no need to have a conversation about the police for the most part. And if it was usually because I had done something clearly wrong, and the police were there to tell my parents I had done something completely wrong, but to deliver me safely to them while telling them the same. It just wasn't really a topic, and it wasn't an issue for us. I made it an issue at points during like high school and probably my second adolescence in college because I was learning about it, but they were just kind of like, what, why are you talking bad about the police? You know, so neutral and almost not talked about, and if talked about in a positive light.
Q or Tony?
I guess I have a, it's a little complicated, what they say. So my stepdad was a police officer my whole life. So that, it never escaped me or was lost on me that Black people were treated differently, even though Black people could be the police. And that definitely, that little caveat was taught. I would say for sure, my interaction with the police probably was definitely positive, for the most part, I would say in my, you know, we're talking about youth now, in my experience of the suburbs, but I do remember very distinctly when I would go and visit with my dad, my dad is the one that explained to me like what was really good in these streets, as far as the police, and just in general, and kind of being aware of how you're perceived walking. And I'll never forget is we were going to an ATM or to a bank, and we were crossing the street, and that was the first time somebody had clicked their car door on me, like locked it, and I was like, and I remember I felt it. And my face must have showed it because then he kind of grabbed my hand and he was like, don't worry about that. Don't worry about that. We go into the bank. But kind of from there, then we would have, you know, every once in a, it was nothing like drilled in, like, this is what you do. This is what you, and I truly believe it's because I'm a woman, you know, and I was a little girl at the time, not a little boy. I'm sure the conversation might have been, would have been way different. But just in general, that, you know, not all police are friendly by default, that you really have to be mindful of, you know, who you call, why you call them. Just there's so many different scenarios that I feel like I was run through to the point that I was like, do I even want to call the police? Because I don't want a hassle, basically. If it's something that can be handled in it within that group, handle it. Don't call the police if you don't need the police.
That's crazy. It's literally, damn. I feel like I'm like the last one. And as soon as I go, it's like something that someone says that literally that's I pretty much same experience. My mom was My mom worked for the Rappahannock Regional Jail in Fredericksburg. So, so she was a cop, you know, and same scenario. Like, you know, we were taught at an early age, you know, I'm about police, you know, and you know, I would, no matter what, be respectful. Like that was pretty much my upbringing anyway. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, no matter the cop talking to you or just some older people, like, it was to be respectful, you know what I'm saying, at the end of the day. So we never really had a fear or a hate for the police, especially my mom being a correctional officer at a jail. Like, you know, she would see so much stuff at work that, you know, she definitely had that conversation, because I'm the only boy. I got two older sisters. So as I got older, she would have that conversation. Like, you know, when you're behind the wheel, you know, even when you're getting pulled over, put your turn signal on so you know that you actually are pulling over, you know what I'm saying? Turn the music down, you know, and just put your hands in clear sight, you know, to be respectful no matter what. So, it wasn't really like a hate for the police or anything like that, you know, or a disrespect for them that I was taught by my parents, you know, just, but again, going back to Q point, we would never even think about calling the police. If something happened, it's almost like, you know, it's like probably an unspoken rule in the black community, like, yo, deal with it. And then that's like last scenario. Like, somebody about to be dead, you know what I'm saying? Like, if they still breathing, mm-hmm. we get to the hospital. Yeah, now they're going 911, put some vocal tests in order, and then we're going to get to where we got to go. You know what I'm saying? So it was like, yeah, I can't even remember, you know, or even like growing up, feel like I had the liberty of just calling the police. You know what I'm saying? That's almost like a no-no, like, you know. So, I think for us it was more like a respect thing. It didn't really turn to me like a fear thing until high school. You know, then, you know, you going to house parties and you seeing things and, you know, cops breaking it up. Cops ain't here to, you know, you ain't a kid no more. They ain't listening to, like, oh, they made me do it and none of that. It's like, nah, you know, stand up against the wall. You know what I'm saying? In the whole, you know, scenario. So I think as an adult, it got real, you know. And it's just a fair, I mean, to really add this short point onto it, my brother-in-law is a cop. And so one scenario, like, you know, and again, this is something, you know, that sometimes we do in the black community that we don't even think about that relates to trauma. I didn't think about it until he said something, until he corrected my sister about it. I remember my nephews were acting up. They were just acting up, wasn't listening to my sister, right? Just being knuckleheads, you know, they young. And so my sister seen my brother-in-law, you know, he was still in uniform. And she was like, yeah, you see, I keep acting up. You know what I'm saying? He gonna take you, you know, take you away. The police gonna get you, you know? And my brother was like, don't say that. Don't say that to them. Cause, you know what I'm saying? You putting the fear in them that, you know, cause that's the number one thing black boys do. They see the cop, they just run. And 9 times out of 10, they don't even know why they run it. It's just an instinct. But you hear it so much when you're young that, you know, it's just ingrained into it. You know, whether you're hearing from a conversation while your parents playing spades or while you're on the street corner, when you just see the police, you just run. You know what I'm saying? And they're just like, well, why? Why are we running? You know what I'm saying? And it's like, oh, yeah, because I'm afraid of them because of something that someone said. You know what I'm saying? And so I think when my brother-in-law corrected my sister at that time, it really made me think, like, yeah, yo, we shouldn't probably do that to kids. You know what I'm saying? And I know it's just an empty threat that parents say all the time. Like, boy, you keep acting up, I'm going to tell that cop to take you away. It's an empty threat. And most of the time, it's like, you know, you don't think twice about it. But it does have, like, traumatic effects. Maybe not then, but, you know, later on, because black kids are generally scared of cops. You know what I'm saying? And now more so more than ever because of what's going on, for sure. But even back then, but I think it's just through how we talk to kids, you know what I'm saying, sometimes. So
thank you, guys. Just to give you a quick tidbit about myself. I grew up in a police family. My dad was a Baltimore City detective. Then he went to be chief of police at Georgetown University. Then he was chief of police at Goucher College in Baltimore. Then he was at Youngstown State University in Ohio. Then he went to Southern Methodist University in Texas. So I lived in Texas. I lived in the South for a little bit, And then we went to Syracuse. He worked up there, Syracuse. And then he came back down to Houston to a black college, TSU, down in Texas. And then he came back to UDC, another black college in Washington, D.C. And, you know, one of those things was, it's funny, everybody, that you guys have said something, we never called the police. I mean, I remember getting a fist fight, whole nine yards. My dad was like, get back out there and finish it off. Either you lose or win. That's what it's going to be. We're not calling. No, don't worry about it. You know, and that's, you know, and my dad was rough on me. He said, I'd rather bust your ass than the cops do it to you. You'd rather for me to yell at you and yoke you up than the cops do it, because you might not come back. And he knows about certain things. And it's so crazy. I listened to him and his friends talk about these police stories. So imagine, he was saying, Baltimore City, back in the day when he worked, he was the only black cop in the detective crew he was in. So if they all stay, so they'll go rob a guy who had watches all on him. And they all get their wives or girlfriends nice fresh jewelry for Christmas. Now, you're the only black guy in that group. Are you going to say, no, I'm not going to do it? Don't you think about that blue shield. That blue shield is strong. And guess what? He went along with it because you didn't want to be sticking out. You didn't want to be known as the rat. You didn't want to be known because you had to fit in. And that was the culture. And he didn't agree with it, but that's the culture that was in back in the day. And I mean, this is talking about 80s, 70s, late 70s, early 80s. It still goes on today, folks. We know that. We know that still. We know there. It doesn't matter what color the cop is, black, white, or whatever. Yeah. It's still that blue shield, and that's what it is. And unfortunately, that's where we are. And
yes, sir.
My neighbor was like, I grew up. We didn't talk about police officers. He was like, we didn't talk about them. They were good people. They were the best people in the world. You know, the sheriff. Everybody likes, you know, what's the famous show with the sheriff? Andy or not Andy? Yeah, Andy Griffith.
Andy,
you know,
Griffin.
Older white guy, happy go lucky. You know, everybody loved him. You know, and then the first black guy I knew was Tibbs from Heat of the Night. I was like, oh, that's a black guy. It's a cop.
Yes, Heat of the Night.
So these are things that we see differently in our lives every single day. And I just want, this is what I want this podcast to, so people can understand. It's not my fault, your fault. We're not learning. It's just, we just weren't around it. We weren't adapted to it. We don't know. And by us talking about this, this gives people opportunity to sit back and go back to their friends and say, let's have that hard conversation. Let's have that hard conversation.